Digital 410 Media proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Dennis Blocker.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II podcast, and we're back live after my trip across the Atlantic Ocean and back, but not to be outdone or to be outdone. Jeff is going to be on his way to the other side of the freaking globe, so we'll get to that here shortly. Dennis, what's going on, fella?
There's a lot going on, but just more of the same old, same old. I'm looking forward to tonight. A lot of good stuff to chat about. It's going to be pretty good.
You know, if I didn't have my beard, I would demand that you grew your beard back because you have a stronger chin than I do. I used to be known as the man with the strong chin before I grew my beard out, but I think if you and I were both to do a clean shave contest, I think it would be hard struggle because you got a pretty strong chin there, fella, ever since you got rid of that beard. How did your wife feel after you shaved your beard for the first time in forever?
Well, I'm not married, so.
Oh, my bad.
I thought you were. Okay, thanks for bringing it up. It's just like really hard to talk
about. I hopped on a cruise ship and I went down to the Bahamas, and I have never seen water so dark blue in my life. It's insane. Like once you get, even just going across the state to Miami, their water is a hell of a lot cleaner than ours is here in Southwest Florida. Because fun fact, we had this big ass lake in the middle of Florida that's surrounded by sugarcane plantations, and all of their fertilizer goes into Lake Okeechobee, and then when they release it, all comes down here and turns our water all these fun colors of brown and green. The natural flow of Lake Okeechobee was to Miami, but they back in like the 50s, they did construction and diverted it over here so not to impact their tourism. So we get their naturally dirty water. But anyhow, drove to Miami, enjoyed the teal water. But when you got out in the ocean, I have never seen that dark blue of water before. It was insane how dark blue it was. And then obviously when we got to Bahamas, you saw the teal green. But to the subject matter of this podcast, I was thinking how beautiful this was, and now the mindset set of being in the Pacific and during the war, you know, you guys are traveling through that beautiful blue water, and then when it comes to time to land on Peleliu or Guadalcanal or whatever that we've been bombing the hell out of for 5, 6, 7 days, how the environmental impact and how the contrast of that burnt, bombarded landscape to that super clean teal water versus a green like river water, it had to make the devastation look that much more devastating opposed to if it had horrible, you know, normal green water that we're all used to seeing. It's like, because I don't know, I guess we take it for granted until you actually go out that far out into the ocean and see, oh, this is what our water's supposed to look like. I knew it was blue, but the color blue in which the Atlantic Ocean is undescribable unless you've seen it with your own eyes. It's hard to decipher and explain how blue that water actually is.
And then the depths by the different color blue, right?
Yeah, because it goes from like dark amazing. Blue to like turquoise real quick.
Yeah.
It's insane. It's amazing. Mm. But Jeff, you guys are getting ready to go on vacation, or do we want to talk more about the fact that I think Dennis got bit by the reenacting bug? Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I'd like to talk about Dennis first. I mean, you heard it, ladies. For those who are listening, Dennis is single. He has a strong
chin.
He's a great rider. So you ladies out there, let Dennis know.
How you doing?
How you doing?
So all ladies, send your emails to mail@wtspworldwar2.com, and maybe we'll have a contest to win a date with Dennis if you live in the greater Texas area, and maybe he'll take you out for a fine steak dinner and talk your ear off about World War II history and other things.
That was absolutely amazing, actually.
Well, let's get into it.
That was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. First of all, Don, you know, I intellectually I knew what I was getting into, right? Because you hear, oh, there's going to be planes there, there's going to be aircraft there, there's going to be other reenactors, there's going to be this and that, and we're staying at a hangar, and you know, so I knew what all of these different elements look like. I just didn't know what they all look like together at one place, And we had an interesting ride up there, and we thought that maybe our trip was going to be literally derailed there at at one point, but worked out. We got there, like, I walk into this hangar, the side door, all the hangar doors are closed. I just walk in a side door, and all the lights are on it inside, and they're just these bright, beautiful, bright lights. And there's this hallway, and I'm walking in the hallway, and I turn. I just wasn't prepared. I wasn't prepared. There's just this pristine P-51 gunfighter right there, gunslinger. And there's B-17 and a B-24. And oh, by the way, tucked behind the B-17 somehow is a B-29. It's just, I just stood there just stunned. And then I just immediately remembered that, oh, we're staying here tonight. And it was just, I don't know. It was kind of like a Twilight episode where me and Jeff both lost like 20 years and we were like teens and we were running around. And it was just freaking, it was amazing.
Which, by the way, for those of you who are Patreon members and you've seen Jeff's exclusive video content, that B-29 looked like someone spent 3 weeks with a chamois and a half a gallon or 5 gallon drum of Windex. It was super clean and spotless, at least on the video. I mean, it literally looked like somebody bought stock in Turtle Wax or Simply Green or something. That thing was as shiny as a coin in a frog's eye or whatever sort of.
Gorgeous.
It was insane. Which, by the way, shout out to Jeff. Good job on that video. That turned out well. Your presentation was well. And if you guys want to see what we're talking about, head over to What's the Scuttlebutt or WTSPWorldWar2.com. Click on the Patreon link, sign up, subscribe, where you can go see the preview video over on our YouTube channel. But so now, are you, what was it like getting into that uniform?
Yeah, you know, well, first of all, the only uniform that I would fit into was German,
That
as
checks
for
out.
what was available. Yeah, it does check out with the strong chin and everything.
Yep.
And you know, it was fine. You know, I was, and it turned out to be, I was nervous, but because, you know, you don't know, nowadays people are so fragile. But you know, I was kind of nervous, but you know, I'm walking around, and it was like, it was a huge hit. Like, everybody wanted pictures with me, and you know, but it gave me an opportunity, and Jeff and I to stand together, and you know, both perspectives, and kind of just, yeah, it was pretty awesome. And what really got me was just the amazing, just these beautiful display tables that Jeff has, and all of the collecting that he's been doing. And it's not everything is unique, everything is important, everything is just perfect for the table. And you can tell, like, so much care and time and selection and specificity went into every single thing that's on that table. And what was great about the place that they set us up was that if you're there, you turned because you're interested. And Jeff is, like, you know, the perfect person. You know, he was just there, and it was just great.
After watching a full day of him repeatedly giving the same presentation with some modifications, obviously, as we all do you kind of understand what I mean when I say it's almost like it's kind of like having a table at a sales convention or a trade
Oh, for
show?
sure.
You're literally you're selling your wares, but in this case, we're selling history. We're not talking about a table full of, shower heads. We're talking about a table full of history, but it's the same presentation. You got to have that same sales pitch. You got to have that same interaction. And for any of you young parents out there, or even old parents, I'm going to say parents of young kids or even teenage kids, another added benefit to if your child wants to get into living history or has even a remote curiosity of getting involved in that, if that is something that's foreseeable for your family, that goes a long way, especially with today's kids, on building social interaction skills. Because as we all know, they're staring at cell phones nowadays, even at lunchroom at table, they're texting their friend who's sitting across from them. But when you take them and put them in an environment where cell phones aren't allowed while the public's around, first few of them, they'll be shy, but they'll slowly come out. The more they learn about what they're going to demonstrate, and the more they've given their little speeches, after 6 months or a year of doing it, it'll impact their daily life. Just the ability to talk to strangers is a tremendous aspect and education value of being in this hobby.
You could see it in their step too. There was a lot of kids there, right, Jeff? There was a lot of kids there that were dressed up, and they were dressed up well.
Yeah, that was really fun to see and talk to and interact with them. I recognized one kiddo that I took a picture with the year prior with the little Lath Air Force jacket and the captain's bars and everything. I mean, it was great. But yeah, I mean, like you said, we had a nice presentation, but the environment, and we need to back up a little bit, Don. So we were literally at the headquarters for the Commemorative Air Force, right? Which is now up in Dallas. So it's a $57 million building, and which is like what Dennis described. That was the main hangar we went into, but the foyer, the entrance foyer, which has a P-51 hanging, a Red Tail hanging from the rafters there, with some really nice freestanding displays. Some are interactive. You hit a button, the Tuskegee Airmen kind of come to life. Uniforms, toys of the period, and sheet music, and pictures of Bob Hope and Clark Gable, and for that to be our setting, for that to be reserved for us, of all of the reenactors that were out there, like, sucking it up in a World War II tent in a torrential downpour that night, and we're inside in the AC watching the lightning from the foyer of the CAF headquarters. It was really special, and I don't know if I've ever been nervous going to a program like that, but I will say that I was at least cognizant of the fact that our display needed to be worthy of the CAF headquarters foyer. For to be in there for 2 days, we definitely had to be more than just, hey, come check us out.
So what I'm hearing is they had a tremendous Windex budget. No, to that point, and I'm sure Jeff may have some of these for different impressions, maybe not for this particular event, but Dennis, one thing that you'll see that were some of the long-term groups, the guys have been around and they specialize in maybe one or two particular campaigns, especially the industrious guys who have a nice a bandsaw at home, is they'll kind of recreate World War II style mission maps, but out of wood so that they hold up, and they'll paint the layers and all that. So sometimes you go to an event, you'll see, a real nice wood map set up of, whatever particular campaign they're talking about. So, yeah,
Yeah, I'm looking forward to meeting those guys too.
but to Jeff's point though, when you're kind of headlining, for lack of better terminology, this event, and you're on the main stage, yeah, you don't want to have local band set list. You got to have your stuff squared away, your presentation squared away. You're going to have somebody like Jeff, who's obviously with his years at the museums and plus teaching, having somebody who does not have a remote fear or hesitation of public speaking definitely comes is required for that sort of thing.
Yeah, and we met several people, like Dennis said too, that younger kids. And I mean, dude, remember Dennis, remember the guy who was there? He's a former Army captain. I'm just gonna lovingly refer to him as Tulsa, and if he's listening, he'll know exactly that I'm talking about him. But Tulsa, man, if you're listening, I can't wait for you to get into the hobby, because he hung around our table, I don't know, on and off maybe 6 hours. Came that morning with his mom, found out that John Luckadoo was going to be there, and then what time. He's like, oh man, we're gonna hang around for that. So he hung around, got to see John Luckadoo, and then came back again. I think it was like something about 5 or 5:30 that he had finally said his goodbye, and I think I met him about 11 o'clock that morning, and just super pumped and super interested to kind of get back in the hobby, get in a uniform, and do what we do and keep it alive. And that to me, when you've got a kid that's interested, or you've just got somebody who is squared away, like Tulsa is, man, it's just, you could, yeah, I get it. It's exhausting. You're talking to a lot of people. Sometimes you're repeating things. I mean, I wouldn't quite call it a sales pitch. I kind of let people browse, let them, answer the first question, or if there seemed to be like they were wanting me to say something, I would just open with, hey, almost everything you see here is original. Let me know if you have any questions. Some of the interesting pieces are this, this, and this. It depends. Or if you've got a girl that's like, wow, this is really cool. Okay, I'm like, hey, have you ever felt real silk? Have you ever felt 100% silk before? No. Here's a silk map. Or Yeah, there was some kids, the siblings, brothers and sisters, like a group of kids. Well, they're not going to care about that so much, but that spiel was about, hey, look at all, this is all the stuff that went to war. Let me show you this steel penny. And why is it a steel penny? Well, let me show you this copper jacketed 50 caliber round or some commo equipment. And so we just talked about war rationing, and things like that. So it kind of depended on the audience, which makes it great because, like I said, you're not trying to sell shower heads, right? You're not saying the same thing over and over. You can read your audience and kind of build from that, but
It just occurred to me, because I haven't really thought about it since the whole thing happened, but the perfect example of trying to, sometimes when we're talking about history or certain things to make people understand or make it more personable, sometimes you try to compare it to something that they may have experienced. And the perfect thing with that food rationing, remember during the pandemic when things first got crazy and went to the store and there was no toilet paper or there was no bottled water or there was no mask, there was no, Kleenexes. Well, they kind of experienced the same thing during World War II. And so what the government did to try to intervene on panic buying or hoarding is they issued these ration stamps. And in order to buy these things, you had to have these stamps. And then they go, oh, that kind of makes sense. And so I never thought about that'd be a good way to bring modern day into some of the, obviously the teenagers who remember those early years of the pandemic, but that's kind of another easy way to use that as an example. That's a perfect example why we had these stamps is so that when you went to the store, everything wasn't barren because people were buying more than they needed.
All right. And that makes it nice because, like I said, we can kind of, I've got a good enough eclectic collection to kind of get interest from just about anybody. And back to what Dennis said, folks came through the foyer and then some of them wanted to go immediately out to the hangar, or some of them saw us. And, it wasn't just my display. I mean, I was connected with a couple other reenactors, friends of ours. They were all in our group. And I want to say it was about 40 linear feet, about 5 or 6, 6 to 8 foot tables. So it was a quite a display. So some people went, oh, I need to look over there. Or they hit it on the way out. So what made it really nice was you weren't bombarded, you weren't fighting a lot of background noise. And I, for some of the people, I can think of one gentleman specifically whose father was a top turret gunner on a B-17. For him, it was a beautiful prelude because he came in, he saw, my collection, I try to make it to where there's some personal effects, things that you would find in a footlocker, things that you would be wearing, in combat, some of the combat gear, bombardier stuff, navigational equipment, tools of the trade. So a little bit of everything, and then just stuff you may pick up in London, just to tie it all together. For him to see that first, and then to walk over to Sentimental Journey, look up that ladder through the front hatch, directly up into that very cramped top turret position, he came back to say goodbye and to shake my hand, and the guy had tears in his eyes. It hit him. He got the full experience of this is what my dad was reading, or this is what was in his pocket. This is what he was eating. This is what he was wearing in the air. This is what helped keep him alive. Then he goes and sees his essentially his dad's workspace, and then comes back in to tie it in. So, yeah, it was a lot of fun. I mean, we just met a lot of great people, a lot of great stories that came out of it. And definitely something that I know Dennis really wants to talk about. I'm hoping he'll want to talk about some of his short stories, and ideas that he's got coming down the pipe, and some of the gifts that we received. And I've got some interesting history for listeners later on in the show. Some about a campaign we don't talk about a whole lot. So I'm excited about that too.
Well, before we get into that, just a heads up, after we do our session here with me, Dennis, and Jeff, at the end of the show, we're going to break away to a pre-recorded one-on-one interview I did with one of our listeners from Belgium named Christoph. And Christoph just finalized his fundraising campaign to pay for two plaques that are going to be located in Germany, the location where the crew of the B-17 called Betsy Ross, who was headed up by Lieutenant Perry Powell, was shot down, and the crew members served time over at POW camp. Not only he did a fundraiser to pay for two plaques there, but the awesome news is he got the government of Belgium to pay for a statue of two of the pilots that's going to be put up in Belgium at the area where the plane went down. So that interview is coming up at the end. He's going to come on after the show. He's going to come on for a follow-up show after the opening of the statue occurs. But I bring it up because, Jeff, you would have been so jealous. He's in Belgium. His area of expertise, because the town he lives in, is the 8th Air Force. And I was asking him, you know, back in the day, was it easier to find a lot of that stuff overseas? Because in my experience, that stuff got sent over there, was used over there, opposed to it being here. He had behind him, during this interview, was a full mannequin like my Steve, completely dressed head to toe with mask, with full all-original Air Corps wool, leather wool, the whole nine. Every piece of equipment, all of it original, no reproduction. Like, I was like, oh, Jeff would love to see that. So he's going to come on for a follow-up episode. So stick around at the end of the show. We're going to play that interview. It's cool to hear all the things that he had to do to get the statue approved and put in place, and let alone funded by the Belgian government, which was awesome. And then the additional steps and some of the restrictions that Germany put on the plaques that he wanted to put up. So stick around for that. But awesome. Before we get into Jeff's talk about the Greece campaign, Dennis, Jeff alluded that you might have some more things to talk about.
Yeah, there's it's interesting the conversations you get into in a German uniform and walking around. And
speaking of walking around, I jotted this down. I didn't want to interrupt you earlier. Did you have on the authentic boots?
Yes.
Now, after spending an entire day in those loud-ass boots walking around on stellar concrete, isn't it amazing that that was considered quality military footwear for the German? I mean, there's no hiding in those things, right? You might have just had a circus following you down the road, because I thought they are, especially in a hangar, I can imagine, they're just the loudest damn things.
Yeah, we had a joke that if all the Allies had to do was just lay ceramic across all the battlefields, and the Germans would have slipped and slid all over the place, unable to run anywhere. and let alone trying to sneak up on somebody, forget about it.
Yeah, but to that point, even if you're not dealing with ceramic tile, those things had to be slippery as hell, like on a large rock. Could you imagine running across a battlefield and coming across a 2-foot by 3-foot slimy stone in the field of France? You had, I'm sure, so many of these guys, especially if you're the poor schmucky that's carrying the MG42 or the tripod, running with that 50, 60 pounds worth of hunk of steel in your lap, and then you step on a wet stone.
That's why they'd switch out with Americans the first chance they got.
I imagine so. I don't imagine there was a lot of padding on the inside between their sock and whatever screws were holding those knobs onto the leather sole.
Yeah, well, you know, being a German, that was a unique experience for me because, you know, obviously, but it brought up some really interesting conversations. I had a guy ask me if I had anybody come up to me, not, you know, angry or anything, but any hostile conversations. And I was like, well, I've had people say, you know, how do you feel like in that uniform, you know? And I would just say, well, you know, I'm just representing the enemy that was there. And how do you feel when you see me? Like, how does that make you feel? Like, that's the really good question. Because when you're standing there looking at the table and you're listening to Jeff, and all of a sudden you hear those hobnails on the floor behind you, that there's also that factor of that's kind of eerie, because it's almost got like the a sound of authority, like clink, 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 you know, and it's like can be very ominous sounding. And I would do that on purpose, where I would walk up to people and checking Ausweis, bitte, you know, papers, please, you know, Ausweis. And people are getting their wristbands and coming up, and I'm standing at the door and checking everybody's stuff, you know.
Well, to that point, let me ask you this, because it's not often I get to ask somebody this. I can remember the first time I did it. I'm sure Jeff remembers the first time he did. I'm sure for you guys it's a little different because you know, you wore real true modern day uniforms. But did you get dressed there or before you got there?
We stayed there that night, so we dressed in the restrooms.
what was your feeling, regardless that it was a German uniform, just for the fact that you had this uniform on, like the first time you put it on and like the public starts showing up? Did you have any weird feeling, like feel out of place? Did you feel like in place? Because I remember like the first event I went to, I got dressed at home and then went. And so like the first time you're out in public, especially you're wearing these uniforms, you feel, you know, for at least for me, the first one or two times, you feel kind of goofy, if you will. But once you get on site and you're in context, it's fine. But
I definitely didn't feel goofy because I have a strong chin and I look like a freaking Kraut. So when I'm walking around, I was in it, you know, and I was there to give people an experience and to represent the museum. And that's why we were there. And they provided us amazing quarters. And so I was there to make sure everybody had an amazing time and that they maybe felt the chill when they saw me walking through with, you know, a flat affect and just staring people in the eye and walking up behind them as they're standing there. And just maybe they could feel that ominous feeling of, geez, like, you know. But, you know, on the other flip side of that, though, and this is more to what you were just saying, my great-grandpa was in World War II as well, my dad's grandfather, and he was in the 30th Infantry, and they were a rock, right? When the Battle of the Bulge, they plugged the gap, like they were the veterans. They in France at Mortain, they had single-handedly held many panzer divisions at bay on Hill 314 by themselves, and they're just tremendous warriors, right? And my great-grandpa had been in this unit, Frank Sobin. And he was killed in action on October 27th, 1944. And he, you know, he's now buried in Belgium. And there's the Robbie and Frankie Mir family have adopted his grave. But I got to say that it made me feel, I did feel bad wearing that uniform. And just because it was really kind of brought home, like, this doesn't represent something cool. It doesn't represent something nice. And I'm not trying to say that there was a message that I was portraying, but the uniform that you wear, it does have a swastika on it and the German eagle clutching that swastika. And it is a military that killed my great grandfather, who's buried in Belgium. So I don't think I'll wear it again, but I'm glad I did. And I gave everybody the experience they wanted and everybody was impressed and everybody got the pictures that they wanted and they couldn't believe a German soldier was there. But I probably won't ever do that again. Just because, you know, historically, you know, all the murder and just, you know, just, yeah.
And that's fair.
It was a good experience for me, yeah.
And I appreciate the fact that you went into it like a method actor. I think that makes for a more enjoyable day for the public around you. And for me as a real actor,
I took it very seriously. Yeah, I
did the same thing even to an ally. Yeah. I try to treat it like a method acting, you know, at least when the public's around. You know, I try to stay into a somewhat of a character. I'm, you know.
And we were very available, Jeff and I and everybody else that was there. We were very available from sunup to sundown. As long as people were there, we were out and about. We never were out of character. We were never slouched over, you know, just kind of with a hand down our pant pocket or undone or, you know, slovenly looking. We were always sharp, always squared away. I was always walking guard. I was standing at the entrance to the door, standing at the entrance to the thing. Standing over by there, you know, and so I was always very mindful that I wanted people to get the experience to see what it was like to be eating a hot dog and look up, and there is a totally decked out, squared away German Wehrmacht soldier standing right there. And there's, you know what I mean? It's, you can see that people do double takes because it was jolting to people to see that. Yeah.
And I think it's also important to point out, because I've had to remind some of our younger guys in our group, I'm like, hey, when you're wearing that uniform, even though it's from 80 years ago, and even though you're a living historian, keep in mind that when you're wearing that uniform, you're representing a group of people, even though they're in their 90s now. So when you're wearing that uniform, act as such. Because believe it or not, a lot of these people, especially if you're in your mid-20s, a lot of people come through thinking you're active military and you just put on this 80-year-old uniform on the weekends as part of a, you know, a training or, you know, a requirement. I can't tell you how many people think that either A, we just show up and there's a trailer outside and we put on uniforms, or B, we're all active service members who are doing this on the weekends. And so I got to remind people, when you're wearing that uniform, act as if, because that uniform represents people. And, sure. And to that point, I have since stopped. Like, now if I get dressed, like before I go to an event, I'll just wear the trousers and the boots. I'll put on a t-shirt, because for me personally, never have served in the military. I have discovered so many people don't know the difference between an 80-year-old uniform and I got so uncomfortable stopping to get gas. Thanks for your service. And I'm a World War II reenactor. I'll pass you. Thank you. I just got to the point now. I'll wear the trousers and the boots. I'll just put on a t-shirt and I'll leave my blouse, my jacket in the car, just because I don't feel comfortable and I don't want to get put into a position where people mistaken me for a active modern day military person.
That's very, very commendable. I really appreciate that. And I know even Jeff, when we stopped at for gas on the way, Jeff was wearing the uniform and he didn't want to go in, and he was active duty.
Yeah.
And he is a combat veteran, but he didn't go into the gas station because he didn't want to represent himself as a captain. And especially since the Army has switched back to the uniform.
Yeah, that's true.
Exactly similar to. So I just, that was very commendable for both you fellows to be honoring the uniform like that. Cause it's just that extra little bit of detail that shows that how much you guys care and how much I care, that does translate and it exudes out of you. And people know if you're just there, you know, got a mullet and you're wearing a freaking uniform. It's, you know, okay, come on now. Or yes, the reason I shaved my beard that I had forever.
If you ever see a picture of me on the internet in civilian clothes and I have the shaved beard and my hair is no longer gray, that means I'm either on my way to reenactment weekend or just got home from one, because I'm the same way. It's like, first and foremost, beards aren't a lot anyhow. But even with my hair, Carrie's like, why do you dye your hair? I'm like, A, it's just hair. And B, I go through the effort of wearing this uniform from 30 yards away with my hair is black. I can pull off mid-30s. Instead of looking like I'm 60, you know, obviously when they get close to me, they'll see I'm an old man. But when I'm out there in the field, if I'm doing a reenactment, a battle reenactment, if I'm out in the field, if I don't have the gray hair, at least when people are taking photos, I look closer to the appropriate age for the event. So to me, it's just hair. It'll grow back. So, but to that point, you know, I get so annoyed. I'll show up to a 2-day event. Somebody has their beards, like, perfect example, the internet meme, no shave November. I can't tell you how many events I've been to. There's some 18, 19-year-old kid there with half a patchy beard. I'm like, why didn't you shave? It's no shave November. It's like, you barely have a beard, fella. I can grow that in 2 days. Just shave it off. I mean, it's just facial hair. Who cares about some internet trend? But yeah, it's so important. It's like, once again, you go through all that effort, energy, and finances to make sure you have the right uniform, the right gear, but then you're going to throw it all away because you don't want to shave.
Well, and people know and they can see that sincerity. And what ends up happening is what happens to Jeff. People will go home and they'll get stuff out of their archive that they've had in their family history forever. They see that attention to detail, the seriousness, the love of the history, and they'll come up and they'll hand Jeff these amazing articles that have been in their family for generation after generation. And they don't know what to do with it. Maybe their kids aren't into the history thing and they're worried that it's just going to get put on eBay by somebody who doesn't care. And they see all that attention to detail, which you're talking about, in the uniform, in the appearance, in the displays, in the talk, in the jargon. We're not cussing like sailors when we're there. We're very well spoken when we're there. And we're not, you know, using common slang. We're not using our cell phones.
Mm-hmm.
And they see that. And people walked up to Jeff. I, the last two times that I've been with Jeff, people have walked up to him and given him artifacts.
To that point, the craziest thing I've ever seen. It was the second year I was in Alabama for the, it was not the Peleliu, but the Tarawa event. We flew some Japanese reenactors in, but we also had like one or two American-based ones. And one of the American-based guys was squared away, right? Had his Arasaka. He had your standard, you know, got the shelter half laid down with all the paraphernalia laid out, given presentations. One of the local volunteer fire person, I think it was a female, her and her husband worked for the volunteer fire department. They came up talking about this Arisaka. Like, you know, what's, oh, that's Arisaka. Is there much value to it? No, they go blah, blah, blah. Like, yeah, we have one in our family, but we're not firearms enthusiasts. They came back the next day and gave him their damn Arisaka free. No strings. Here you go. We don't like firearms. Have this Arisaka. We know you'll take care of it.
Wow.
It's like, holy crap. So, I mean, I've seen some cool stuff. But so it does happen. And to Jeff's example, as you're pointing out, when you're as squared away and as knowledgeable as Jeff is and make yourself available as Jeff is, that's how you end up finding yourself participating in other people's projects, whether you're being a military advisor or somebody's asking you to help research a particular topic. And so the way you present yourself and the way you show yourself off at these events can oftentimes open up opportunities, because somebody may have an idea but they don't know where to go to get help, and then they see someone like Jeff standing there with such a beautiful display and knowledge. I wonder if that guy would be interested in helping. And that's how oftentimes you find yourself in cool situations that's revolved around the hobby.
Well, you know, Tammy, my wife, came across a really neat quote. She read it out loud to me the other day, and I know you two will really appreciate it, because it has to do exactly with what we're talking about. She said, you weren't born too late. You were born now to make sure that other generation doesn't die.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
That really resonated. Because I jokingly say, oh, I was born 60 years too late. You know, I should have been born in 1923. I would have been 18 in Pearl Harbor, yada, yada. But thank goodness I wasn't, because, you know, when you experience something, it's never, you know, how we perceive World War II and how the guys that were there perceived it are two different things. They didn't see the glory. They didn't understand that the music they listened to, which was just simply present day music, was going to last for decades and decades and decades. And the style of uniform, and, you know, but you wouldn't, you know, when push comes to shove, you wouldn't want to be one of those. You wouldn't want to have had to live through the Depression. You wouldn't have wanted to live where the entire world is at war. And I mean, it was terrible stuff. And they, you know, they just did a job. And so, you know, yeah, I kind of jokingly say that, but no, at the same time, I'm very fortunate that, you know, I'm in the position I'm in the time that I live in, to make sure that's not forgotten, because, you know, because we care about it so much. And that's why it's like old hat to the, when you talk to these guys, you know, oh man, what was like, I don't know. It was you know, like, it's nothing special to them, but for guys like us and our listeners, it has some sort of magic to it, or some kind of majesty, you know, to the experience, to the uniform, to the aircraft, to the music, you know, that whole compilation of what it's like and what we like to surround ourselves with. When we listen to it and when they listen to it, it's totally different. And I'm thankful that I'm in the position to see all the good, you know, the good feelings that it can kind of, you know, bring up, as opposed to the all out terror that it really truly was.
Yeah.
And I think on that note, now would be a good time to lay some history on some folks. So we're going to hand it over to Jeff, and he's going to talk to you about part of a campaign that I don't think we've ever broached on this podcast. We've done a whole lot on ETO, a whole lot on the Pacific, but the Mediterranean, the African campaigns, things like that, we have yet to really touch on in any in-depth. So maybe this will be a new chapter, or at least a look into, and hopefully we can come down the pike with more of this content.
Yeah, and I'm certainly hoping that our listeners will chime in with questions or comments, or, you know, for those of you listening that know more about this than we do and would like to, you know, contribute, please let us know. So, like Don mentioned earlier, so a week from right now, I'll be traveling to Greece as, you know, a teacher that linked up with a company out of Austin. I'm taking six students with me. Most of them are seniors. One of them is my son. And it's something that my high school has done for over 20 years. And by one of the history teachers, he's done it for many, many years, with the exception of the COVID years, of course. And as he is, getting older, doesn't want to travel as much, got grandkids and everything, he kind of passed it to me, kind of a passing of the torch to keep the legacy alive, because he said he's taken over 200 students from our high school abroad,
Wow.
which in a high school that never has more than about 1,100 students at any given time, it's a big deal. That's a big deal, because it's not cheap, but it is. It's really special, and I'm just so thankful to him and the opportunity that I have. So, I get to pick the location. You can go most places in the world, and so I thought, let's start in the beginning, right? The birthplace of democracy. So I put a Greece trip together, and had six students that are just super pumped that we leave, next week. And so as we're getting this close, the tour director, you get assigned somebody who lives there, and this girl is literally going to basically latch on our group. And she will be, I mean, she'll be at the hotels with us, on the bus with us, everywhere. She's in charge of making sure we have a great time. That's on top of the tour guides, things like that. So she is our tour director. And she had reached out to me and said that, if there's anything special you want to see, there's some days where we've got some afternoons free, and if some of the students don't want to go here, if they want to go somewhere else, you just let me know. And I thought, oh, okay. So we're going to Athens, Delphi, Meteora, the monastery in the sky, up to Thermopylae, way up and over to Thessaloniki, and back down to Athens. So pretty good chunk of mainland Greece, not going to Sparta or anything like that. I'm most especially excited about Thessaloniki, headquarters to Alexander the Great. But when she asked if there was anything specific I wanted to see, the wheels started turning. Okay, the only thing I know about Greece and World War II is that the Germans occupied it. That's the extent of my knowledge of the Greek campaign. So I thought, okay, this is a great time for me to learn a few things, do a little research, and I sent her some things and some suggestions, and I cannot wait to see what she pulls up for us. But what I wanted to share with the listeners was something that I thought was very interesting that, yeah, we know we haven't talked about it on this podcast. It's hardly talked about ever, but I think it deserves mention. And this comes from the Washington Oxy Day Foundation. Oxy, OXI. I hope I'm pronouncing that right, because it is a Greek word. And I'll talk about that here in a minute. So, Anything But Trivial is the title of this article, Forgotten Facts About Greece and World War II. More of Hitler's troops died in one day on Crete, Greece, than in any single day in the 15 months prior in 11 countries.
Wow.
More of Hitler's troops died in one day on Crete than in any other day in the past 15 months and in 11 other countries. That blew my mind. It says here, overall, one out of 10 Greeks gave their lives during World War II. Adolf Hitler said the Greek soldier, above all, fought with the most courage. And Winston Churchill said, hence, we will not say that Greeks fight like heroes, but that heroes fight like Greeks.
Wow.
It gets more interesting. Greece's disruption of Hitler's war timetable forced him into the debilitating Russian winter, where he met defeat. Leaders like Winston Churchill, Joseph Stalin, America's Sumner Wells, and even Adolf Hitler's chief of staff, Field Marshal Wilhelm Keitel, credit Greece with bringing about Hitler's defeat. Keitel said the Greeks delayed by 2 or more vital months the German attack against Russia. If we did not have this long delay, the outcome of the war would have been different. Greece was the only David in World War II able to inflict a fatal wound that eventually brought down the Nazi Goliath.
Jeez.
President Franklin Roosevelt said, when the entire world had lost all hope, the Greek people dared to question the invincibility of the German monster, raising against it the proud spirit of freedom. Hitler had previously soundly defeated France and routed the army of Great Britain, two of the world's great powers. Life magazine and publications around the world featured Greece on their covers. Now, Oxy Day is that was another, like, okay, another little rabbit hole. What exactly does that mean? What's the story of Oxy Day? And it says here, as the free world watched, as one by one, countries across Europe surrendered to Hitler's Axis forces, at 3 a.m. on October 28, 1940, a representative of the Axis forces arrived at the Greek prime minister's residence and demanded Greece's surrender. The prime minister replied with one single word, Oxy. No.
Huh. Wow.
A few hours later, the Axis forces descended on Greece, expecting that it would quickly fall. But the Greek resistance forced Hitler to change his plans. News of Greece's victory flooded the radio airwaves and covered the front pages of newspapers around the globe. A grateful world celebrated. No one expected such a small nation to derail the seemingly unstoppable Axis forces.
Wow.
I am very excited for next week because I will certainly do what I can to capture some good video content of me at some of these places, potentially where Panzers came through some of these gaps. Dennis, I mentioned to you earlier, you know, I've seen pictures of the Ju-88s and the Stukas and the Do-17s sure. flying over, you know, the Parthenon. But this was a big deal. And yeah, Greece fell pretty quickly, but so costly. And it's not talked about.
Yeah.
To that point, for the audience listening at home, here's a fun thought experiment, because I just did it and I couldn't do it. Close your eyes, and in your mind, try to envision what the Greek infantry uniform looks like. You can't, because no one ever talks about it. I just Google searched it. If you saw it in passing, you would think it's a Russian uniform. I mean, it's... I couldn't even imagine what their uniforms in World War II look like, because so little pop culture. I mean, I'm sure there's some out there you'd have to dig for them, but when's the last time you've seen, oh, you got to watch this World War II movie, it takes place in Greece? I never heard anybody say that. So, yeah, I mean, to that point, that we often talk about how there's so many stories and so many campaigns and so many people who fought in the war that don't get talked about, that a lot of focus gets put on other campaigns. Here's a perfect example, as Jeff says, you know, here's another great campaign that we know little about because it just didn't get the coverage.
I'm looking forward to seeing you shooting video wearing a What's the Scuttlebutt t-shirt in one of those gaps yeah. in Greece, talking about what Panzers coming through there, you know. That's going to be amazing. Yeah. I'm looking forward to that. Jeez.
Yeah, and you know, you can do a quick Google search and find some maps of you know, Hitler's invasion of the lower countries through there and Albania and Yugoslavia. And, you know, you kind of get the idea that, I mean, I think most people know Greece is a pretty rugged country, you know, from a topographical standpoint. So when you think of, you know, armored, you know, columns coming through, gosh, I mean, there's got to be only so many places to be able to get all the way down, you know, to get to Athens, right? I mean, that's not in the northern part of the country. So what does that look like? I'm curious. You know, like I said, you kind of just see coming in, but there's really only one or two routes. But I just got a kick out of the prime minister response. I mean, is that almost not like, you know, deputy commander of the airborne at Bastogne?
No, we're not
giving in.
You know, sometimes the simplest answers don't need any elaboration. No. You want to say anything else?
It's known as no day now.
Yeah, let's save on ink and time. I don't need to.
See day.
Yeah. No need to type it up. Just no.
Yeah.
No.
That's awesome.
So, you know, if any listeners, you know, if they've got anything to add, if there's some great things that we just don't know about, you know, great ways for research, or maybe there has been a documentary or two, an independent film, a short story, maybe there's a short story that needs to be written. You know, I'm interested in what anybody else has to say about it, because, again, it's so overshadowed, but I feel like it's feel like it's pretty important, you know, hearing some of those big people talking about it between Churchill and Roosevelt. I mean, my goodness.
Especially the fact
it's almost
that
like the Alamo. The fact that the Alamo fell.
That many Germans died on an island that was 113 miles long by, I think, 35 miles wide at the widest. I think the total landmass of Crete is 3,225 square feet.
So, is Crete its own country?
Or it's an island.
Is it part of Greece?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I don't know that geography.
Yeah, it's under the purview of Greece, but it's an island in itself.
I remember seeing, I don't know if it was that World at War documentary, which, by the way, folks, if you have not seen, a lot of it is narrated by Sir Laurence Olivier. And a lot of the key players, I'm talking hundreds of the key players on all sides, are interviewed in this series. It's amazing. But they do show some very significant footage of Crete and Greece just being bombed relentlessly, and people emerging from these hovels that they've created of stone and coming up and putting their flags back up and putting their bread stands back out of defiance. It's just gives me goosebumps.
Yeah, I love when you see that, and then you got the guy pulls out the broom. Like, yeah.
Just starts sweeping.
Yeah. Oh, man. Not going to hold me down.
Goodness.
That's an example of a great show and production to watch. I'm going to give you guys a 2-minute example of a movie not to waste your time on. I was sick a few weeks ago, and Jeff and Dennis held things down, and thank for them for doing that. The night before, I'm laying in bed and I'm feeling like crap, and Carrie's on the TV and she knows I love World War II stuff. She knows I've seen just about everything on the major channels. And she's like, here's a World War II movie on Hulu. You want me to add it to your list? And I got my contacts out. I'm trying to sleep. And I put my glasses on and I look at the TV. And it's this movie called 3 Days in Malay. And she reads the description to me before I put my glasses on.
Oh, I know where this is going.
And she reads this description of 3 Days in Malay, which is a 2023 movie that is out on Hulu. And it's a small group must defend the airfield for 3 days against a Japanese assault during the fight for Malay in World War II. And it talks about this Marine squadron. And I'm like, huh. Not familiar with that. I put on my glasses. I look up at the splash screen where they have the thumbnail for the movie. And it says 3-day Malay and has a description, United States Marine, blah, blah, blah. And then they show this photo, which is overhead. And all you see is 1932 haversacks that the Army wears, the horrible one, the netted helmets. And I told her, I said, I'm not watching that. She's like, why is that? I said, because you just read me a description of the Marine Corps, yet they have two Army soldiers in European theater of operations with the net helmet and everything. I said, they didn't wear the... She's like, well, isn't the Army in the Pacific? I said, yeah, they didn't wear the helmet nettings.
Oh, it wasn't the flag the wrong flag. It was.
I didn't even pay attention to that, but I just saw...
It was a 50-star flag.
I just saw two Army soldiers in ETO uniforms in a movie about Marines in the Pacific, and that was all I needed. She said, well, let's turn it on just to see what it's like. So they turn it on, and the very opening scene is this Japanese charge, and it's real dark, but I'm like, those uniforms just don't look right. And I'm all trying to get to the TV. And they cut to the next scene, and they're at this Pacific base, and it's a wide shot, beautiful wide shot. And they have this table set up, this nurse sitting there in her Army uniform, and they show these Marines walking by, and I'm like, why are they wearing jump boots? Marines walking by, like, why are they wearing black jump boots? And one of the stars walks up, green HBT. But you can see the four stitching holes on the buttons. I'm like, the HBTs had riveted. And I lean forward and he turns. He's got these bright yellow sergeant chevrons. Bright yellow. I'm like, that's late Vietnam. They had these guys in mid-1980s, like, Army uniforms. Like, you see them wearing in... like Iron Eagle, like they weren't even World War II era freaking uniforms. They had them in the black 1980s Cochran jump boots. They had them in cotton HBT green pants with the cargo on them. They had them with the bright yellow nameplates from post Vietnam. They had the bright yellow chevrons. And then they cut to another scene. The guys are all Oh, they cut to the scene where the sergeant's got his beard going, and I'll send you the photo. I went back after I told you guys briefly. The guy who's playing the one-star general, he's in there. He's got, like, on this horrible imitation Eisenhower jacket with, like, one star on each shoulder. They got him with an M1 helmet lying around with the chin strap choking his head off. He looks like Doofy on Scary Movie. He's got one big star in the middle. It looks like someone's high school like movie project. It was the worst. And the sergeant's like screaming. I'm like, why is a sergeant screaming at one star general? And then I was like, I guess I gotta go to bed. And then they cut to the guys like working out, and they got on black Hanes t-shirts. I'm like, okay, I'm done. I've since seen someone else complain about this movie on Twitter. So unless you guys are just wanting to watch this rubbish ass movie for the fun of it. To make fun of it, just go ahead and remove 3 Days in Malay from your Hulu playlist, because it is the biggest piece. Like, they didn't even bother. I guess they didn't even have even someone of military, like, historian who just wanted a film credit. They couldn't find anybody. It's like they just went on, like, Alibaba or, like, one of those military surplus stores and just bought whatever uniform they could get in bulk. Like, hey, they got 83 pair of black cock and jump boots from 1984. Cool. You know, so they just bought whatever uniform they could find. And then the best part is, I didn't even get this far, but I went and looked at the screenshots. In the combat scenes, they got them with the early 80s uniforms, but then they got the leggings tied on over their black cock and jump boots. So then they put leggings and, like, reenactment like M1 belts and really bad suspenders on it. So at some point they end up slapping army uniform web gear on these Marines and their 1980s army. I can't believe this thing even got financed. It's ranking as the worst World War II quote unquote movie. Because if they didn't even say World War II, you would have just thought this was just some random HBO movie that takes place in the 80s somewhere. It's just horrible. So that's an example of a movie not to watch. Jeff, I see you got a sweet book behind you, fella. What you reading?
So I'm still reading Harry Crosby's A Wing and a Prayer. After watching Masters for the second time, I had to revisit this book. And Don, I know you weren't with us the last episode, but I kind of touched on it. You know, I read this book, probably the first book I read about the air war or even the ETO in general. And I want to say I was about 15 when I read it. And I mean, I remembered bits and pieces of it, especially watching Masters. I was like, oh man, I kind of remember that. You know, I remembered it from his memoir. But other than that, a lot of it was just way over my head. And I read, there was a chapter I went through just a couple days ago. And I, if you'll indulge me, there's a couple paragraphs I want to read here. I think you guys will find it interesting. He's already group navigator at this time, and he's having a hard time kind of fitting in. He's not the raunch, the cocky, you know, braggadocio that the Buckies were. He's kind of a pretty squared away guy. And he says here that he said, I felt strange about having a good time in England. Okay, we were flying combat. Okay, the 8th Air Force combat losses were higher than those of any other military service. Our one Air Force, the 8th, was losing more men than the entire U.S. Navy. When I was flying on a crew, my whole life was flying and recovering from it. I lived with combat crews. I ate with them in the flying mess, with the fresh eggs, Canadian bacon, and fresh orange juice. When I joined Eager Beaver Blakely's crew, I spent most of my time in training, and I was exhausted. As my mission stretched out and I flew less often, I missed my friends who went down. When I went on pass, I usually checked in at a Red Cross club and spent most of my time sleeping, trying to recover from the exhaustion of altitude, responsibility, and loss. It didn't seem right that after a mission, I could go down to London and see a stage show. The GIs on Guam or at Kiska spent the night in their foxholes. It got to me. Now that I was group navigator, I might lead a task force to Germany and then not fly a mission for a month. During that month, my friends went down or home. When I thought of my friends, Sergeant Lyle Nord, Hambone, Brady, Charlie Villa, Ernie Warsaw, Jim Scott, or Sumner Reeder, I had to sort them out. KIA, MIA, POW, stateside hospital, interned in Switzerland, or rotated. It got to me. I found myself rather numb to it all. I did my job, but I don't remember much of it. So we talk a lot about the Band of Brothers and the Pacific and LCI 449, but the Air Forces, the Army Air Forces in Europe was really a special, unique case because they lived in very different realms, you know, throughout the day, very different worlds that visited. And Harry Crowley talks about that. And some days he's, you know, 5 miles up, and then he comes back, and then he's in a pub in London, or he's, you know, wrapped in a letter from his wife, and he's back home in his mind. And that back and forth is I know that's tough. I mean, I'm not going to say I think that's tough. I know that's tough. I remember being rotated home for 10 days in the heart of my deployment, and it was the absolute worst possible thing they could have done. Did I need a break? Probably. Did I want to go home? Absolutely. But it wasn't a day or so later I'm thinking, oh, I got to get back. Like, I got to get back, because here I am, and I'm hanging out with my girlfriend and her family and my parents, and we're eating dinner like normal human beings, and I don't know what's going on with my guys. Oh, how many car bombs have gone off since then? Are they okay? And here I am, some sad sack in the States. And then, you know, like, you're already scared to go over, and then you know you got to do it again. Like, if you just go over once, you know, that's enough. So I couldn't imagine that going up into that cold blue and then, you know, freezing your tail off, and now you're in a warm pub with some, you know, pretty red boss girl on your sleeve. And then that red light goes on, and you know you got to do this crap again. And then you look around, and the guys here partying and drinking and ordering a double-double, and they may not be here tomorrow, but you may be. And then you're pulling cards, and you're back in a warm – you know, it's just that back and forth just had to have really taken its toll emotionally and physically and spiritually even for some of these guys. And it's an interesting part of Harry's book. It must read for anybody interested in World War II in general. I mean, it's one of the best memoirs out there, hands down.
Speaking of Masters of the Air, did you reveal to our audience your Masters of the Air hack?
I did not.
Maybe I'm like looking online, because I'm going to do the same thing. So maybe you should share with the audience how you were able, as someone who does not have Apple Plus, to watch Masters of the Air twice. Share the love.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're looking at a cheapskate, right? I mean, yeah, I know I got a lot of nice things. So, thanks to. Thanks to our wingman, Dennis the chin blocker, because he does have Apple TV. And so, you know, I got to just totally binge watch it with him, you know, a few